afternoon and welcome to the LaRouche Show. It is Saturday, January 28th, 2012. I'm Harley Schlanger and I will be your host. As most of our listeners know, since the period before Christmas, Lyndon LaRouche put our organization on a full-scale alert to mobilize against the threat of war, which was coming from the British financial elite operating through their puppet, President Barack Obama. Behind the war drive was a simple fact. The transatlantic financial system has collapsed, and people are going about the business of trying to breathe some life into it. It really is like putting blood in the corpses in a morgue. There's not much happening, but the fact is that this is their system, and the British default position is war and depopulation. And as LaRouche pointed out, after the murder of Muammar Gaddafi, there is a full-scale push for destabilization of Syria and for an Israeli or U.S. strike against Iran. And as Lyndon LaRouche has pointed out again as recently as his State of the Union address back on January 18th, the actual target of this is Russia and also China, the two primarily Pacific-oriented nations, which are not going along with the globalized fascist policy of the transatlantic region. Now, our organization, as I said, was put on a full mobilization, and in part, that mobilization played a leading catalytic role in building resistance internationally. There was resistance from Russia and China to the war drive, but also in the U.S., from the military and sections of the intelligence and foreign policy establishment, and also in Israel, from the military and intelligence establishment. As a result, the war has not yet been triggered. But anyone who saw Obama's State of the Union address this last week realized that there's not only a continued push for war, but Obama makes George W. Bush look like a candidate for a Nobel Peace Prize. His insanity was on full display when he started his speech and finished his speech with the mission accomplished of killing bin Laden, killing Gaddafi, and continuing the deployment against Iran and Syria. Now, it's not just that Obama's insane, and we, of course, have been demanding his ouster for a long time, but also you see the insanity of both parties. As Democrats in the Congress have gone along with this, all the Republican presidential candidates are basically going along with either the economic insanity or the foreign policy war drive. The media, even the U.S. population, why was there no outpouring of anger, calls for Obama's removal after his completely insane State of the Union address? Well, that brings us to the second aspect of LaRouche's mobilization, which we'll be discussing today. So the first thing that he said we had to do was tell the truth, awaken people to understand there is a war threat. But the second thing that we have to do is organize the population to not only recognize the truth, but learn how to discover what is truthful and what is not. And this has been the organizing task that Lyndon LaRouche has been discussing over the last weeks. It was at the center of a very interesting, fascinating discussion on the weekly report this week. How do you change the way people think, and in particular in the transatlantic region? So on our program today, we have three younger organizers who I guess it's fair to say were formerly members of the LaRouche Youth Movement. They and their colleagues have been taken full responsibility for the kind of economic, cultural, and scientific revolution that Lyndon LaRouche is leading. So today we're going to discuss with them what they've been doing in this mobilization, what kind of reactions they're getting, and also get from them their thoughts and ideas on how to win this fight for what truly is the immortal souls of those who live in the transatlantic region, who have allowed themselves to become a bunch of slaves of the British Empire. So joining me today will be Madeleine Fellauer from Germany, and I believe she said she's in Stuttgart, but she's been all over the country there. Jennifer Kreingold from Boston, and Mihwa Steger joining us from San Francisco. So as we say in Texas, I'd like to welcome you all to the program.
Hello, thank you. Hello.
Hi, Madeleine, let's begin with you, because Christmas is usually a special time in Germany where people put on their nightcaps and go to sleep for about 2.5 weeks, including in the past our members. But this year, we not only deployed straight through, but we had a fairly extraordinary mobilization. And I'd like you to give our listeners in the United States, as well as around the world, a quick report on what we did to alert people to the war danger and what kind of reactions were we getting.
Okay. So we got, before we started the mobilization, we got 100,000 leaflets printed. And we start, even before we had the leaflets in the offices, we started to call our network of people who are part of the organization to help us distribute during Christmas time. And half of the 100,000 leaflets went out to people who said they're going to help us distribute. That was a major part of this campaign to bring the war danger threat of Third World War to different cities, not just where we have offices. And most of the people who did actually help out were very excited, and they continue to call in still today to get more leaflets and to distribute, because they had so good reactions when they went out and talked to people. But what we did is every office made a huge banner saying Stop World War III, and we took this banner to churches, to the Christmas markets, to basically every place where you can find people on Christmas. And the reaction was actually very surprising, because especially at the Christmas market, you expect some people who are drunk and just wandering around for shopping. But maybe it was because of the paradox we posed to them and their coziness. We said, okay, we need to impeach Obama and to stop the Third World War. And a lot of people just took the leaflet, and they didn't say much in the beginning, but it was a very silent reaction. They took the leaflet and said, thank you that you're out here, but they didn't say much more.
By silent, I assume that a lot of the people were very thoughtful, and did you find that people had some inkling of the danger? I mean, the Libya story was very well covered in Europe.
Yeah, especially around Christmas, I think people were more thoughtful than usually. Some people, like in October, right after the Gaddafi assassination, some people actually did say, yeah, this was right, and he was a dictator, and they just didn't get the whole picture just from the Libya case per se. But the media was full of war propaganda against Iran, against Syria, it's still today, and people sense that it's not really about Iran or Syria, that there's something much bigger at play.
Well, Madeline, let me ask you, because as Mr. LaRouche and Helga Zepp LaRouche, who's the leader of the Busso Party in Germany, have been emphasizing, that this war drive comes out of the complete collapse of the transatlantic financial system. And Germany, of course, is the one country where everyone has been saying, oh, Germany's in good shape, Germany's got to bail everyone out. But we're beginning to see coverage in Germany of the growth of unemployment, the slowdown of the economy. Are people beginning to get a sense in Germany that, and also people have known that Germany's being called on to bail out the euro. What do you think? Are people beginning to get nervous about this also? And
yes.
Do they make the connection to the war?
Yeah, definitely. They get, like if you put it in the bigger context, LaRouche put it, that the British imperial system is collapsing, and this collapse will unleash war and dictatorship, then people get immediately the connection to Greece and Italy, where they have actually dictatorships. Monti or Papandemos, they were never elected. So that's what people get, and that, like, the situation in Greece is so, for people it's clear that it's very desperate, and that we have actually, yeah, as I think, Giulio Tremonti said it's fascism, and that is clear for people somehow, and that is in Europe, right up
okay.
front.
And Madeline, we'll be getting back to you in a minute, because I want you to be very much a part of this discussion. But let's shift over to the United States and to the cradle of revolution, Boston, Massachusetts. At least it was a few hundred years ago. Jenny, how was the mobilization there? And it's clear, I know that in Boston we've had a very dramatic uptick in the organizing. What was the key to that?
Well, I think the mobilization, there's two aspects, especially over the Christmas period. One of the key aspects to our mobilization here has been the intervention into the culture through the chorus and the singing, and I think really appealing to people's souls directly. But what we've found in the recent period, there is, I think, a sense of the calm before the storm. We're in a very interesting period in the United States. The population is in a certain sense, what we're finding is really desperately looking for leadership in a certain sense, but then there's also a tendency to want to kind of look for the lesser of two evils, which, what we keep reminding people is, hey, we've done that before. Look where it got us. Let's not make that same mistake. And so what we're trying to do is really, because there's nothing within the current framework that's telling people what they should do, it's obvious that what people are being given as a so-called alternative to Obama and the whole system is crazy, and it's demoralizing for people. So what we're trying to do is really appeal to their imaginations, and this has been a real, I think, interesting challenge here, just trying to really talk to a lot of people, and some people are going to respond, some people are ready to look for an alternative and to think much bigger, some people aren't quite there yet, but I think the point is that as the situation, in the coming weeks, it's going to become, becoming obvious that there's nothing else to turn to right now, that civilization is at a turning point. And so we're finding there is an openness by some people to really think much bigger than they normally would.
And Jenny, part of the challenge that Lyndon LaRouche has thrown out to the younger people, we do have a slate of six candidates, one of whom is very well known up in the Boston area, Rachel Brown. And that this slate is constituting itself as a national slate, as a kind of voice of a presidential campaign which doesn't exist within the other candidates. How have we been doing that in the Boston area with Rachel and with the overall deployment?
Yeah, well, I think it's very clear for people that what people are very open to is the fact that we're not sitting around waiting for the elections to talk about changing things. The crisis is now, and what defines our candidates and what defines Rachel is that she and the other candidates have been intervening. They didn't just step on the scene like Superman when things got bad. They've been there fighting, warning every step of the way that things were going to get bad, and so that really gives them an authority that nobody, not just that they've warned that this is going to be happening, but that we've also been preparing ourselves, the candidates have been preparing themselves with solutions. So we're finding a real response to this presidential slate, for sure. And we have some upcoming events with Rachel and the basement team and, to really get at some of these core questions of going to Mars and a fusion economy, and we really want to get the population thinking at that level.
Good, and we'll get back to you in a moment. And by the way, I think Rachel put so much fear of God into her opponent last time, Barney Frank, that not only did he decide to retire from Congress, but he's going to try and find some place where he can marry his longtime boyfriend.
Yeah, I know. We were wondering whether he was going to invite Rachel to the wedding.
And now let's go to the other coast of the United States. We have with us Mihwa Steger, where we have in San Francisco the Summer Shields campaign. And Mihwa, we've had a significant uptick also in the San Francisco Bay Area. How are people responding to the, you have a kind of a general population that would tend to be anti-war as you would in Boston, but also until recently suckers for Obama. What's your sense of what's happening in the population, and what are we doing to move them?
Well, we have had intense discussions in terms of the field, and just the organizers ourselves, through the Christmas period with Lynn's initiative of let's just break through this mass insanity and expose the war danger. But we have committed to getting the population in the field, especially, to commit to an idea, something that they haven't even seen actualized. Because here, I mean, you've got Berkeley, you've got the anti-war movement, but you also have people that are thinking. They're definitely thinking about what the future of the nation is. That's what we've found, because the Christmas period was intense from the standpoint that we were out there with high visibility deployments, you know, with banners like they had in Germany that say impeach Obama. The Hitler mustache, I mean, he's proven that he's earned every whisker on that mustache, especially with this national defense bill that says he can indefinitely detain any U.S. citizen on U.S. soil. And that we've used that to basically confront people and say, look, this should be intolerable to you. And people in the field, maybe they want to find you, they want to complain about this, but we've forced them to come above it and find solace in the fact that we're out there doing something. You don't want to find comfort in talking to us about, you know, how much you hate Obama, but let us give you the proposals that our six candidates are moving forward with, which is a mission to Mars, a revival of the space program, a commitment to bring back our manufacturing and industrial base. But you can't do that with Obama in the way, because he's in the way of Glass-Steagall, and that would be a first step towards bringing back a real credit system.
Now, you mentioned the Mars mission as a part, as Jenny mentioned that also. Lyndon LaRouche has put that up front as a flank. Of course, we've seen nutty Newt Gingrich with his proposal to send a man to the moon with a rubber band and give $20 billion to whatever firm can do that. Then you had Mitt Romney come out saying, no, we don't want NASA doing that. What are you finding, Mihwan, in the Bay Area, you know, which is somewhat known for technology, although usually the wrong sort, but there is a technological base there. What do people think when we grab them and say, look, we intend to go to Mars?
Oh, what I found the last week especially is surprise, because people have really responded to this. I've organized in Houston, and I've seen the response through the NASA initiative. But here we've got Lawrence Livermore. We've got these commitments to real nuclear capabilities and thermonuclear capabilities. And the response has been pretty optimistic, because we're not putting it out there as some, you know, crazy sci-fi idea. It's that, you know, when a person like George Washington, as he's lost 90% of his army, he's lost most of the battles in the American Revolution. He specifically on that Christmas day fought for an idea of a nation state and of sovereignty. And so how we represent this to people is that you're not going to be able to see all of this happen right now in front of you, but you actually have to fight with the question of optimism that this can occur, and that it's worth fighting for.
Okay, this is the LaRouche Show, and we have a special panel today of younger organizers who have taken up the challenge through the Christmas period and beyond. And now we're in a particularly crazy period of time in the United States with a so-called election. Of course, in Europe, you've got elections. We have Jacques Chaminade's campaign in France, where Sarkozy is about as popular as cholera. As Madeline mentioned before, you've had police state dictatorships, banker dictatorships set up with Goldman Sachs former officials in Italy and Greece. And so we're talking about what we have to do to move the population beyond just being angry or demoralized into real action. Madeline, I don't know what we're doing with this Mars initiative in Germany, but of course, the original impulse to go to the moon came from German scientists. So have we been able to generate some excitement with this?
Yeah, especially among young people. I know since I'm here in Stuttgart, I can see there's a university here in Stuttgart, and everything you can study is space engineering and reactor technology, civil engineering. And those people are very excited about this, just the optimism and the perspective to change the basically last 40 years of wrong policy. But for some other people, it's more difficult. But what we used is from the last basement report, this graph about the increasing energy density of the universe, and that we have to kind of, we have to make people clear that we as a human species have to increase our technology level or our energy flux density to keep up with the universe, and that we actually did went backwards since the assassination of Kennedy. And that makes it, for some other people who are not by nature excited about going to space, it makes it more clear for them.
Well, this is interesting that you bring it up, because of course Stuttgart is also the site of some very intense battles around the whole question of the so-called environmentalists, the Greenies, who are trying to shut down a modernization of the rail transport center there. And then obviously on top of that, there's a certain quality of German pessimism, which has come from the result of the 20th century and the deployments literally against Germany that led to World War I, the imposition of Hitler, and then the imposition of the euro after the unification of Germany in 89 and 90. So you're saying now that we're finding, especially among young people, a new quality of optimism? Is that what you're saying?
Yes.
And is this also seen in terms of the reaction against the environmentalists in Stuttgart?
I can say this right now, through basically every layer in society, there's a reaction against the Greens, just because they, like there was a popular referendum on this station here, and then the majority of people in Baden-Württemberg voted for the new station, and there were still the demonstrations going on, and the whatever, last week they chained themselves to the trees that were supposed to cut. And that was totally...
I heard the trees were protesting.
Yeah, but population now says this is actually terrorism, what those people...
Sure.
Because it's totally illegal now. Because there's no reason to do it. They got, like, a democratic vote, and it said they want the station, so... There's a lot of anger against those people hiding at the station. But in general, it's like, it's for people, a lot of people react to the war, but we still have most of the people who are against the war are actually in their hearts, and they are Greenies. So that is something we have to cut through, because somebody once said that the absence of, or the absence of war doesn't mean peace, because we need development. And that spills the beans among the people, so to speak.
Right, right. Well, now, Jenny, also the fight in Boston, somewhat like San Francisco, Boston is historically known as a liberal anti-war town, but then we have this Senator John Kerry, who's done everything possible to clear the way for Obama to launch nuclear strikes against Russia. I mean, Kerry is one of the cheerleaders for the Libyan war. What's the reaction when we talk to people about the immediacy of the war danger there?
Yeah, people recognize it here. And I mean, I think the biggest problem is just the sense of not quite having the sense that they can act to stop what's going on. And but people recognize this. I mean, and there is a recognition that there's a whole crisis, like a crisis of humanity, that this is kind of the point of a point of real tension in the situation. So, I mean, one thing that we've really tried to do is to make people, because the is not really responding to their pessimism, because people want to say, yeah, I know, you know, the situation's bad. People recognize that how Russia is responding and trying to stop this war drive. You know, people see these things, but there's a sense where they say, well, we can't do anything. Obama's going to be in there. All we can do is vote. And so we have to really get people to imagine something much bigger. And I think that's the biggest challenge for the organizer, is to not get, because what people are seeing now is not reality. What they're being presented with is not reality. And we know the reality. We know how to act on the universe. So the challenge is to get people there with us.
Well, and as we've been reporting, there's something in the range of 40 to 50 to 60% of the Republican voters who say they want another choice. I think someone was saying recently that 80% of the American voters want none of the above when it comes to these candidates. Romney, of course, is a former governor of Massachusetts. I don't suppose that does much to help him with the people of Massachusetts, given the crappy health care system he gave them. But what's your sense when we intervene? I mean, this question I'd like to take up the rest of the program is the question of how you change people's thinking so they can recognize what Madeline was talking about, taking out this chart on energy flux density. I mean, it's clear what LaRouche has challenged us to do is to give people a different sense of what it means to be human. You mentioned earlier, Jenny, that you were doing that through coral deployments. Just give our listeners a little bit of a sense of what you see when people encounter us singing on deployments.
Well, I think one thing is we create at least a temporary culture that they can step into and really be lifted up, lifted out of their the daily rot of daily culture. Because, I mean, people really have been degraded by this whole, even this whole election process is really degrading to people.
Right.
And I think we really have to have a sense of lifting them up and really kind of being able to look, like, be above and look down on what's going on and realize that you can actually be above it and shape it and intervene, and not from a bottom-up approach.
And what does, how does music do that?
Well, I think it it appeals to your, it appeals to your soul in the way that, I mean, it presents ironies to you which you otherwise would not necessarily recognize. It creates it changes your concept of time, which is, I think, really an important question for people. Like it almost when you're in a listening to a piece of music, especially live, when you see a chorus on the street, you're almost frozen in time, and you're almost experiencing an idea that's being fully developed and fully worked out in front of you. And so your mind can experience a moment of creativity, because the composer is able to bring you through a creative discovery, almost extrapolated in front of you. And so you can give people access to their own mind and say, well, look, this is, you know, you see how your mind responds to this? That's actually how it should be working. That's actually how your mind should be working.
Well, and Mihua, you've made the use of the chorus on the West Coast a really effective political weapon. I'd like your thoughts on this, the use of music as a way of transforming the way people think.
Let me just address one thing in terms of the organizing, is that a lot of people think that things right now are inevitable. Like, it's just inevitable. We're just going to get another loser in the next election. And, I mean, the slate of candidates or parade of candidates that you have are offering nothing in terms of a policy. And so there, what Jenny was bringing up in terms of appealing to their soul, the main thing that you have to do when you're confronted with this person is that you realize that they're submitting to their senses. They're submitting to, you know, what they see, hear, feel, you know, taste and touch. But when the chorus goes out there, they're able to lift those people out of their senses, out of a sense perceptual realm in which they translate everything they think they understand. And for that moment, they're able to think. And you're giving them the capacity and facilitating an environment for them to be able to think. And it's a very powerful thing, because Lynn brought this up over and over and over again. And for the people in the organization and the people that we intersect in the street, the question of metaphor and how you're able to understand how the human mind works. And you take a look at a Bach fugue, and you see sort of a direct representation of what a creative idea through the mind is. And it's not for you to be able to explain it, but there is a certain mental experience that comes with having it uttered, or you participating in uttering it yourself, or having it live, as Jenny said.
I was going to ask you on that, because there's an interesting paradox in what you're saying, because you're saying the chorus lifts people out of their senses, yet the entry point of a chorus is the sense of hearing. So go ahead, elaborate a little more, as you were just starting on this question of metaphor, how you actually lift people above that, even through their hearing.
Well, sense of hearing, but honestly, what are you hearing that utterance with?
Right.
Because once the first note is uttered, the second note, the relationship between them that's created, and then, you know, so on, it develops into an actual musical idea. Where does that start? Where does the germ of that start? And what? How is your mind able to, I wouldn't want to say translate it, but understand that? Because it's not your ear. It's not the percussiveness of the frequency of the note hitting your ear. But it's also not just the note. It's the relationship among them that communicates an idea to the mind, that's recognized to the mind as something beautiful. Because it actually represents and reflects the organization of a harmonic universe. That's why when you hear something that's, you know, totally disjunct, like Igor Stravinsky or the 12-tone system, atonal system, it's not beautiful from the standpoint of being reflective of something truthful. There's something sort of sadomasochistic about it, if you do enjoy it.
Well, you're hearing notes, but you're not quite
your
sure
sense
what
of beauty.
Yeah. But and Madeline, I'd like to ask you, because Madeline, I know that we have a Schiller Institute conference coming up in Berlin at the end of February, and in the last several conferences, music has been a central feature in the conferences, with the beautiful performance of the Beethoven Ninth Symphony. The choral movement at the last conference, what was it, last July, I think. Yeah, Germany, of course, is a nation where you have this great music, and yet much of it is either unappreciated or butchered in the form of the Regie Theater operas. How are we, do we take the chorus out in the street sometimes in Germany as well? Do we do that as part of the Christmas deployments?
I know in the Berlin office they deployed with the chorus, but in general we do it. But we have what we do is specific deployments to concerts, with where you meet a lot of people who are already in a different mindset, so to speak, and we have very good reactions there, because as Jenny and Micha said before, it just changes the imagination of people, and they can actually imagine that there is the possibility of creating a better world, one could say.
And also, I want to get back to something you brought up earlier, the use of the concept of energy flux density in the organizing. This was the focus of the weekly report this last week, with very excellent presentations by Sky Shields and Ben Denniston. And I would encourage our listeners to go on to the LaRouchePack.com website to see the weekly report from this week with that discussion. But Madeline, when you talk about bringing higher ideas, I mean, clearly in Germany now you have the shutting down of the nuclear industry. You have, even if the Greenies are losing some of the momentum, the part of the reason is the CDU and the SPD, the two leading parties, have become green. How do you intend to carry out this fight that Lynn has initiated around this question of energy flux density, fusion power, and Mars? What's the discussion among the organizers in Germany about how to do that?
So far, what we discuss is we do a lot of interventions, because there's still, despite that the energy change or the exit from nuclear was decided upon a while ago, there's still some people talking, like giving presentations on the need for nuclear power, etc., and we try actually to mobilize those people to come out of their woodworks to just go in public. I know we had demonstrations for nuclear power in Berlin. We are in contact with those people, and of course they are pretty pessimistic about everything in Germany. So they also need a lot of this optimistic approach towards the colonization of space and manned space flight, going to Mars, industry base on the moon, that they actually get back their fighting spirit.
Well, this is something that has been at the center of what LaRouche is talking about in terms of the transatlantic region, because you have under the Euro system essentially a dictatorship of bureaucrats in Brussels who are just functioning on behalf of the banks. Now, two questions I want to throw out to you, Madeline, and then I also want to see what kind of response we get to this in the United States. One, what people think about the situation with Russia and the reemergence of Putin and the attempts to destabilize Putin. And then secondly, in Germany, the reaction you get when you talk about the euro as an imposition of the British imperial system. So first on Russia and then on Britain. Madeline?
Yes, on Russia, I can say in general, on a lot of so-called issues, there is a complete change within the population. So what we have in the streets, that people are very attentive to what is going on in Russia. A lot of people just say that is exactly the opposite of what the media is saying, but they are also kind of getting clearer that the media is just lying at them all the time, no matter if it's about Russia or the euro or about Obama or the war danger. And they look forward actually for this development perspective. They notice that Russia is doing a lot, like they offered to help Greece building infrastructure. That's what a lot of people know. And so it changed. And they see that, if you put it in the context that Russia and other nations in the Asia-Pacific region, that they actually want to develop, and they develop now the industries that in Germany people are too scared to develop. This is kind of, it changed a lot.
Mm-hmm. And on the British Empire and the Euro, is there any recognition at all of the analysis that LaRouche has of the Euro being an extension of the British Empire over the continent?
A lot of people now recognize that the Euro system is bad for Germany. That is a one step in a good direction. Because before everybody said, yeah, it's for the peace of Europe and the European Union, and we didn't have war since we have the Euro, and that is becoming kind of obsolete if you look at Greece and Italy. But what we do in the organizing, we bring the whole Euro system actually in connection to the policy of the City of London running the whole world through the monetary system, that the Euro is basically a colony of the City of London. And people kind of sense that there's something wrong about London being the headquarters, because everybody noticed that people in Great Britain or Cameroon, for example, are talking about saving the Euro system and blah, 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 but then they don't want regulations for their City of London. Yeah. So that is kind of clear for people, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Now, Nihua, I wanted to ask you on the question of the Trans-Pacific, because we've had a very significant focus going back to the last Summer Shields campaign in 2010 with the Four Powers Conference. And the difference between the Chinese approach, where the Chinese are planning to go to Mars, the Chinese are building nuclear plants, to what extent are we building on that with the Shields campaign to really develop a constituency in that area for these kinds of national and international cooperation policies?
Well, we had a conference in Chinatown. Actually, right now we have an import from China through France. Her name is Yi Qing, and she's been here for the last month and a half helping make some breakthroughs within the Chinese community, because we are sort of low on Chinese speakers. But we had a conference back in October, and this Pacific Alliance that Lynn brought up, with the initiatives between Russia, the United States, and China, is basically the equation for the solution towards defeating the British. And in the United States, that's fundamentally what our tradition has been, to defeat the British. And the British will always use people like Obama, like Hitler, to push through policies, especially times of complete financial breakdowns, to use them and the Middle East as chess pieces, and to provoke a sense of divergence from what the real potential is. And I mean, Lynn's very well known up here. We had the largest number of subscribers to our science publications sort of focused in the East Bay here. And we've seen a real breakout, because we brought up the fact that, look, this is the guy, LaRouche is the guy that proposed the SDI, the Strategic Defense Initiative, in the 1980s under Reagan. And this is what Reagan went with. We would have had no problem with nuclear war or weapons had this policy gone through. And we're in the situation now where, you know, we've got troops in Turkey, we've got troops in northeastern Australia. This administration is pushing us towards this war danger to consolidate essentially his dictatorship in the next election. But the population here is really, the Chinese population especially, has responded to the tradition of Sun Yat-sen. And we've been translating summer statements into Chinese, going into Chinatown with a chorus. We just had Chinese New Year. And that was fun, because there was just a sea of people that we were able to intersect with Summer's statements.
Good. And, of course, we're talking about the defeat of the British Empire. What would this discussion be if we didn't turn back to Boston, where the revolution started? And, you know, Jenny, this is one of the funny things, is that You have the Boston Irish. Sometimes it takes a couple of minutes, maybe a drink or two to get them going. But you do have this anti-imperial sentiment still, at least in sectors in Boston, don't you?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. You just scratch under the surface a little bit, and it really comes out. Absolutely.
And some of this is in the form of the anger at the Boston vault, the banks, which continue the relationship with the City of London.
Yeah. Yeah, it's there. I mean, we tapped into it a lot during Rachel's congressional campaign. But, I mean, there is an incredible patriotic impulse here, which we're really trying to appeal to with people around the Constitution. I mean, you know, people who are staunch defenders of the Constitution, they really, I mean, for example, people recognize here the reaction to the National Defense Authorization Act that Obama signed on the 31st of December. I mean, there's a very strong reaction to that here, because when you get down to it, people, they will defend the Constitution. But the problem is that, again, this question of knowing how to fight, that's where we come in. But there is this patriotism here, which is, it kind of comes out in waves.
Now, we have about 15 minutes left of the program, and I was wondering if Nihua or Jenny, either of you had any questions for Madeline about either the organizing in Germany or what we've been doing. Do either of you have a question for her?
Well, I'm curious because we do use the Hitler mustache here. And we get a lot of people that, especially from Germany, not too many anymore, but I mean, I don't think you use it there, but because that's basically our strongest, most provoking flank, especially with our sign.
Yeah, no, we don't have the mustache in Germany. That would cause some uproar here. But the reaction on Obama changed a lot, because as in the case of Russia, people don't buy the media line anymore. And we had actually some of the best responses on the NDAA, the National Defense Authorization Act. People were just coming up to the table. We have a picture of Obama where he has with things in his hair like Caesar, and he's turning his thumb down, and it says he's the plaintiff and prosecutioner in one person, and that is kind of strong for Germany. So there's a lot of reactions, and people just come to the table and want to know what is going on, and everybody now says, yeah, I sense that there was something rotten about him. But it's more people say he's a non-personality, that he doesn't have any character. And it's clear kind of that he's not going to act to defend mankind, but he's actually on the contrary side of mankind.
Yeah. Well, Madeline, in the defense of your organizing, I think it would be against the law in Germany to put a Hitler mustache on Obama.
Well,
not just that it would cause riots, I think we'd probably go to jail.
Riots in the United States with it, too.
Yeah. And Jenny, did you have any questions for Madeline?
Well, I was just curious about the sense of patriotism, what that's like in Germany and Europe. I don't quite have a sense of that, because I know here it's very strong. It comes out in certain ways, like if you bring up John F. Kennedy or Lincoln, you know, people kind of, they get very prideful. People are very proud of these certain historical individuals and what they represent, and it's, sometimes that's the way to kind of get them to move, and I was just wondering how that takes form in Germany, like patriotism.
Yeah, in Germany it's a bit, they don't have a real, a person they can remember that was a patriot, a politician. Like the Helga always says, the last real patriot was kind of Bismarck, and that is not tangible for people. But what they do associate with is that Germany was once the country of the poets and thinkers, and that we had this big economic miracle and this drive for technology. That's what people respond most to, in terms that we as a nation, that's what we represent, that's the real Germany, and that's what they also associate with.
Madeline, isn't it also true that there's still a very strong emotional reaction to John F. Kennedy in Germany?
Yes, of course. Yeah, we use it a lot.
Yeah.
It's, people do, yeah, they think that he was a good politician, that he was the last good politician in the United States, or last good president, and that they really admire the space program, the landing on moon. Because I think it's also because when Germany was divided, we were the right at the front of the Cold War, and that was kind of set off during the moon landing. No one thought about it, oh, it was just an American, or they forgot about the tension.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Ah, interesting. Mm. So I have a question for each of the three of you to round out the program. I know there are a series of conferences coming up in every location, but I'd just like to get a sense, Madeline, start with you, of you know, what we can expect in the weeks and months ahead, assuming that this war threat continues, which it will until Obama's out. There's going to have to be, well, there's two things going on. You've got the war danger, and you've also got the collapse of the financial system. At what point do you think there'll be a rebellion in Germany against the Merkel government and against the idea that Germany is the bailout of last resort for Europe?
Well, that's hard to predict for Germans. Not really calculable. You cannot calculate what they do. But I just read Helga's new statement leaflet on the website, and on Monday, which is January the 13th, the European Union will decide on the fiscal package, whatever they call it, which is going to implement the debt break and automatic sanctions for deficit sinners, what they call it.
Yeah.
And I mean, that is the revolt in Greece and Italy is spreading, and people don't want more austerity. And as far as I know, Fitch just downgraded five European countries, and it becomes so all people clear that if Merkel says, or if Merkel sticks to the ESM, the European Stability Mechanism, then that would actually mean that Germany has to foot the bill. And who's going to, there is no one left. If Germany saves everybody, no one is left to save Germans. I think that, yeah. I mean,
except the Wolf.
Huh? Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah,
except
sure. That's what Wolf actually said, our Bundespräsident, the federal president, in a speech. He said that the, if the bailout continue, who's going to save the one who's bailing out everybody? Because there's no one left. So I think that, from my insight into the situation, it will change very soon.
Well, that's why this conference is so important. And you know, I think we can go ahead and say, can't we, Madeline, to Americans who would like to come to the Schiller Institute conference in Berlin, check with your local office, but I think we'd be willing to have some Americans show up there, wouldn't we?
Yeah.
Yeah, so that's February 25th and 26th in Berlin. It's a formerly great city, and we're going to make it great again. So if you can be there, if you'd like to see what the organization is in Europe, that would be an ideal opportunity. Now, Jenny and Mihwa, you're both in cities where we have the slate candidates. What are the plans? Jenny, you mentioned there's some events coming up. We have some listeners in Boston. What should they do if they want to participate?
Well, we're going to have it posted on the website as soon as we nail things down, but we want to have a conference, some sort of big conference, in probably in March, which will feature at least Rachel, possibly another member of the Slate, and some members of the Basement team. Really a day-long conference, similar to what some other places are doing, San Francisco, Texas. But we really want to challenge the population in this period, because I really think in the coming days, people are realizing already that what they're being given as a so-called alternative to Obama is more of the same and crazy and dangerous. And I think as long as we're there and we're telling the truth and we're providing the leadership, I think people are going to respond. So we're going to be having that, and people should just stay up on the website to find more about that.
And meanwhile, what about the events coming up and activity in San Francisco if people want to get active?
We have a few satellite meetings, specific satellite meetings in the scientific community around Livermore, and where most of our constituents have responded the most. We want to consolidate some real leadership among the people that consider themselves contacts. Summer's going to be speaking at these with a panel of some other people, but we are moving towards a larger, we also have a conference in Chinatown February 5th where I Ching will be addressing the Chinese community in Chinese with Summer. And translating for them. So we're building for that February 5th. And then towards the end of March, a larger Mars mission conference. The details for that aren't completely solidified yet, but obviously Summer and a few of the Basement members are the focus there.
Okay, Madeline, I have one last question for you. Are people in Germany watching the U.S. election?
Yes, very closely, actually.
And are they
so
horrified by what they see?
Yeah, today the guest commentary in the Stuttgart Zeitung, the Stuttgart newspaper, talking about Newt Gingrich going to moon. But it's widely acknowledged that there is a presidential campaign, and most people they stick to what is reality, that there's no difference, and that the real candidate hasn't yet shown up. Kind of, but there's it's recognized. But I think like what we do in Germany, we organize a lot around the Slate, actually, as being the only viable policy for the United States. Because if I think that's not proven, but that most Germans get really, really badly pessimistic when there's no change in the United States. So if there's something positive happening in the United States, Germans get get optimistic. So.
Well, now there's something for our organizing in the United States. It's not only useful to make the United States great again, but make someone in Germany happy and optimistic.
Yeah.
Let's go out and dump Obama and make the whole nation of Germany happy. I think, in fact, if we could get rid of Obama, the whole world would be happy.
Yeah.
Yep.
All right. Well, we're running out of time. Any last comments from any of the three of you?
No, I don't think so. Not from here.
No.
Okay. Mihua, you always like to be heard last.
Oh, really? There you go. There's my last. You know what that means.
All right. That's the last word. Well, look, I think it's very important. I'll repeat this, that people go to the website and look at the weekly report from this last week with a fascinating discussion about the actual creative nature of the physical universe. And I think it was Madeline who brought this up earlier, that we as human beings have a responsibility to evolve and develop more quickly than the non-living aspects of our universe, or we will be overwhelmed by the galactic storms ahead. And I think the discussion from Ben and Sky is extremely important, and then the comments from Lyndon LaRouche at the end are absolutely essential for people who are organizing now, because we're not just organizing about facts or issues, we're organizing about the nature of man. And I think if anything came through on this discussion, it's from three very different locations on the planet, San Francisco, Boston, and Stuttgart, or the North Rhine-Westphalia, where Madeline spends the rest of her time, that mankind needs to change, and that this is the subject of our organizing. So I'd like to thank the three of you for joining us, and be happy to have you back again sometime.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Okay, and we'll be back next week with the LaRouche Show every Saturday at 3 p.m. Eastern Time on LaRouchePub.com. And don't forget to go to LaRouchePack.com so you can be a real human being.